Hey everyone, it's the Kung Fu Genius, aka Alex Richter. And if you're listening to us on audio only, I'd appreciate you rating and reviewing the podcast wherever you listen to it. And of course, if you like what I do here, don't forget to subscribe to the Kung Fu Genius on YouTube and hit that bell for notifications. Are you a fan of Wing Chun Kung Fu? Well, if you listen to me, I assume you are. I got great news for Kung Fu Genius fans. Right now, you can get an all-access one-month free trial subscription to Wing Chun Illustrated Magazine. Yes, I said free. Go to WCINewsstand.com and register in the upper right-hand corner, fill in your email and password, and use the code KFGTRIAL to get your free trial to the issues from 2011 to the current issue. That's right, all the issues, even the one with this guy on the cover. My Kung Fu Genius column is in all the new issues, as if you need another reason to get this awesome magazine. Go get your free trial subscription today. For all that information, check out the description below. And with that, let's get started.
All right, peeps, on today's episode of the Kung Fu Genius, the genius will be answering all sorts of hot nonsense from YouTube. Lots of gems, lots of DKO, lots of does Bruce Lee really recognize Japanese nipples? Let's get to it.
He is unstoppable, unbeatable, unbelievable. He's Alex Richter, the Kung Fu Genius.
And every day, I practice martial arts. What's up?
Word is, I'm a Kung Fu Genius. Practice all day like a genius.
Yo, Dre, how you doing, man?
I'm good, Sifu.
So finally, we've decided to just wear normal clothes for the podcast.
Finally.
Yeah, I was a little worried because you came in with a nice jacket. I see what's going on, but I think we're done with that now.
I think so too.
Yeah, I mean, I pretty much beat you because I came in with a tuxedo, so I've won that war. All right, so we're here for another Ask Me Anything episode, so let's get right to it.
Let's get right to it with Luke Cap.
All right.
Okay. Got any tips for starting to teach your own class? Own your own studio?
Ah. Well, yeah, this is a question that I get quite often from martial artists and obviously many from Wing Chun, like how do you run a school? How do you start a class? And it's difficult because if I really tell people everything that's involved, they would never want to do it because it's a lot of work. And I think sometimes people think that, okay, I like martial arts. I like doing martial arts. I like teaching martial arts. And those are all absolute prerequisites to running a martial arts class or school.
Yeah.
But the lion's share of what you're going to be doing, the teaching the class part, which is the part that we like, that's the fun part. But there's everything else you got to do to set up the business, to keep it moving, to keep things, you know, in working order. And obviously, if you want to earn money or at least break even, you got to learn, you got to have some business acumen or at least learn those skills.
Yeah.
And so there are a lot of resources online for people who want to learn those things, like how to run a school, things like that. But I would one thing I would stress if someone now wants to open a class or open a school or whatever, is that there are many different models for opening or teaching martial arts, all right? So obviously now in this pandemic, you know, we have like the Zoom era where you can teach things online, you can have courses and videos and things like that. So there's ways to, you can teach online, even though it's not ideal necessarily for things like Wing Chun, but there's things that you can offer in that kind of way. And then you have to decide if you are gonna teach like face-to-face live classes, do you want to just teach a class one or two times a week, or do you want to actually have a full bore school? And so that's one of the things you have to decide. Also, there are new business models within martial arts schools. You don't have to, for example, have a traditional group class martial arts school where you have like group, like what we have here. You have group classes and you offer private lessons, seminars on all these things. There are business models now for private only martial arts schools. And of course, there are people who've been doing that for a long time, Sifus who only teach privately. But I mean, like you can actually have a brick and mortar location that's private only. And so there's a lot of different models. You get like a small boutique size gym rather than a full martial arts school where you're only going to teach one or two people at a time. And there are models for that as well. So I don't really have any tips because there's so much you have to learn to run a martial arts school successfully that by me saying like, yeah, well, just do this and just do this and you'll be fine. It's like the people online telling you like, you can get shredded by doing these five easy steps. It's like, no, you have to, if you want to get shredded or bulk up or be strong or whatever, that's literally all you have to be focused on for that time to accomplish that. It's not a matter of five simple hacks, right? And it's the same thing with running a martial arts school business. And I've been mostly disappointed by people who have actually sought my advice on running schools. I remember there was a Kung Fu school that opened in Brooklyn a few years ago. And, you know, I knew this guy through social media. And when he opened his school, you know, I came there for like, I think either his grand opening or the first week he opened, just to kind of wish him good luck and give him like a banner from our school and stuff. Oh, cool. And then while I was there, his assistant asked me like, oh, well, you know, you have the school in Midtown. Like, you know, what are some of the things that, you know, you could give us as advice, right? And then I basically, you know, gave him a list of like, here, like five really practical things. Like, I'm not going to tell you how to teach your classes or whatever, but like, here's some really practical ways that you could like contact students and prospects and things like real kind of nuts and bolts kind of stuff. And every single thing that I suggested, they're like, oh, no, we can't do that. Oh, no, we can't do that. Oh, no, we can't do that. And these things are like industry standard. These aren't, I'm not like saying like, you know, you have to send drone spies into your potential, students' houses or whatever. These are things like, oh, you should get some kind of automated text messaging when people contact you through the website so you can get their information, yada, yada. I was like, oh, can't do that. And then I was like, all right. And then 6 months later, that school didn't exist anymore. So it's like, you know, okay, like, don't listen to the guy who has been running a school in Midtown Manhattan, one of the hardest places to run a brick and mortar space, for nearly 20 years.
Yeah.
Say you can't do anything, don't do any of those things and do it your own way, and then you can see what happens, right? Because pretty much how we run things here at City Wing Chun is pretty industry standard for martial arts business. And those things work, right? And if you have good classes and good instructors and you teach enthusiastically, the rest are just business systems. And unless you're really willing to learn those things, there's no five easy steps to running a martial arts school or class or anything.
Awesome.
Be serious about it and everything else will fall in place.
All right. Good stuff. All right. Next up, we got Richard White, Dryson's arch nemesis. Wetson.
All right. Not Dryson, but Wetson.
Arrives at City Wing Chun to challenge Dryson to a duel.
Oh, good. Finally.
Yeah.
Someone calls him out on his bullshit.
Yeah, right. Wetson.
He's also assuming that Dryson is at City Wing Chun.
I know.
Which is weird, right?
Really weird.
Yeah.
Maybe he's hanging out with his cousin, Nah, son.
Nah, son.
All right.
Wetson is the same height and weight as Dryson.
Uh-huh. So trains, a buck 05.
Yeah, something like that. I really don't know how much Dryson weighs.
Oh, okay.
But
I can, well, we can guess.
Yeah.
Right.
We'll read.
Yeah.
Dryson and trains in Bakmai.
Bakmai. Yeah. White eyebrow.
Mm. Okay. He also leaves the faucets running after clogging the bathroom sinks. A real asshole. Who wins?
That's the question. Wow.
Who wins
in a hypothetical battle between a hypothetical person?
Yeah, we don't
and
know
a hypothetical
who Dryson
arch nemesis. Yeah, we don't know, because the thing is, I actually don't know what Dryson looks like.
Yeah, we don't know.
I literally
anything about
have
this guy.
No idea what the guy looks like.
Yeah, we know what he kind of thinks like. Of. We know his brain wave style.
I've got a pretty fair idea of what Dryson looks
like. So I don't know. It's impossible for me to answer a hypothetical about a hypothetical person.
Mm-hmm.
That's all I got to say about that question.
Man. He is an asshole, though.
He is, though. I would say that.
We do know that for sure.
Yeah.
All right. Next up, we got Evan D. Can you give some explanation on this? In Way of the Dragon, when Bruce Lee tries ordering food, how did he end up getting a bunch of soups?
Okay.
Another odd thing I'd like some context on. In Fist of Fury, how did Bruce know the cook was Japanese from his nipples?
Yeah, those are two somewhat important plot points in two separate Bruce Lee movies. Okay, so the first one, Way of the Dragon. Mm-hmm. Now, if you watch the old American version that came out that was dubbed, I don't think that scene is even in there. So you have to watch like the international version or the original version. Now, remember, if you're going to watch Way of the Dragon, you have to watch the Cantonese version because that's the only one that makes sense.
Okay.
Because, you know, Bruce goes to Italy and he only speaks Chinese and everyone around him speaks presumably Italian, but often English.
Oh, right.
And he doesn't understand them, right? But when they dubbed it into English, they just dubbed everyone into English. So like I said before on another episode, as a kid, I always thought it was strange that Bruce would go up, because I saw the English dub version first, and Bruce would go up to people and be like, hey, tell him. And I'd be like, why can't you just tell him? You're right in the room right there, right? Because in the original version, he's telling this guy in Cantonese. The Cantonese translator has to, you know, translate it to the boss or whatever, right?
Look at him.
Yeah, and I remember as a kid just going like, I don't understand, like, you know. Tell him this. Yeah. I'm like, you're right there. You can tell him yourself, right? You're a tough enough, badass enough dude. Why you need this middleman right there, right? Because in the dubbed English version, that made no sense, right? So in the original version of Way of the Dragon, the opening scene, he's at the airport. Mm-hmm. He just arrives in Italy, you know, because he's there to kind of help his uncle who's having some problems at the restaurant. And the way Bruce Lee wrote the script was that he wanted in the first few scenes to really show that Bruce is a country bumpkin, that he's like an outsider, because it wasn't that Bruce's character was from Hong Kong. He was from the New Territories in Hong Kong. And at the time in the 70s, the New Territories was like, that was the countryside. So it wasn't like he was coming from Kowloon or Hong Kong Island. He was coming from the countryside, right?
Hmm.
So he's supposed to be a bumpkin for Hong Kong standards. So he wanted to, in the first few scenes, show that this guy is basically a country bumpkin, which is part of the reason why Bruce's character wears Chinese-style clothing, which, because that movie is supposed to be, it's a contemporary film. It's supposed to be in the 70s, in the time period that it came out. It's not supposed to be in the 20s or in a historical era.
Okay.
So in 1972, when that movie was made, most Chinese men from Hong Kong, you know, in their late 20s, early 30s, would not have worn that Chinese-style clothing, right?
Gotcha.
So the fact that he's wearing it, you know, that's why when Nora Mao's character first sees him and she kind of looks him up and she sees that he's wearing this Chinese-style clothing, she's kind of like, ugh.
Oh, okay.
Like, what's the deal with this guy? Yeah. Like, he's not even wearing modern clothing. So in the effort to establish that character in the first few scenes as being a country bumpkin, he gets off at the airport. That's like the opening scene. And, you know, Nora Mao's character, who's supposed to pick him up there, he doesn't see her. And he's kind of hungry. So he, you know, he's looking for a restaurant and he finds a restaurant in the airport and he goes in. But the problem is he doesn't speak the local language, which is Italian. So he sits down and then they hand him the menu and it's like a very Western style restaurant.
Okay.
Presumably it's an Italian restaurant. It's an Italian airport he's supposed to be at. And they hand him the menu. And in the film, when you watch it in the Chinese version, he looks at the menu and he's like, oh, man, because the menu is not written in Chinese and he cannot read neither English nor Italian. All right.
Okay.
I think the menu was in English, but it could have been in Italian, but either way, he can't read it. So he sees the menu and he's like, ugh. And then the waitress comes over and he's just like, he looks at her and he's like very embarrassed because he doesn't speak any English and obviously no Italian. And he goes, Gaitan, like he asked for eggs, like, but he asks it very sheepishly, like, and then she just looks at him like, what? And he's like, you like he cannot even order something basic.
Yeah.
She obviously speaks no Chinese, and so he looks at the menu and he opens it up and he goes to the section of the soups, presumably because the soups are appetizers and they're cheaper.
Mm-hmm.
So I would assume he looked at the price and they're like, let's say five soups there and they're only like a few dollars compared to the entrees, which are a lot. He might have thought these were like little dim sums.
Oh.
So he just looks at the menu and he cannot read it and he points to three or four of them. He just points to
thinking
them like this.
Dim sum.
Well,
okay.
He's thinking he doesn't know what it is. So he just randomly points to these four things and she looks at him like, who orders four soups? Okay. And then, you know, she takes the menu and then comes back with these four soups. And the waitress is, like, looking at him like, you really going to eat this? And he's there and he's looking at it and he's like, ugh. And these are, like, four different types of soups. And he eats them. And then he gets bubble guts afterwards and has to use the toilet. When he sees Nora Mao, he's like, oh, I got to use the toilet.
Oh,
and that
no.
becomes, like, a recurring theme because in a couple scenes, he's like, you know, she brings him to the apartment and he's like, he's like, where's the toilet? So she's really not impressed with this guy because he always needs the toilet, right? So he's trying to like promote this character as being a bumpkin and then like, oh, constantly needing to use the toilet. So because basically until the reveal, I mean, you know he's Bruce Lee and he's an ass kicker, right? But if you just watch the movie by itself and you didn't know anything about Bruce Lee, kind of until that, I mean, he throws some kicks at the beginning when he's with the prostitute or whatever.
Yeah.
And, you know, he has that, like, pose out there. But, like, until the scene where he fights the thugs in the alley,
yeah,
you really don't really, I mean, you kind of have the, okay, obviously you see he's very impressive, right? But that's the moment where all of a sudden there's a big reveal that this dude is an ass kicker. But up until that point, he's supposed to come off like a total, like, noob and rube from the countryside. So that soup thing was kind of part of setting that up, right?
Damn.
So, so that's the first one. Now, the second one was a question about Fist of Fury.
Yeah.
Which was, you know, there's the scene where he comes in and he sees the cook. Because, you know, the Sifu, you know, Fok Yun Gap was murdered, supposedly beaten in a duel by the Japanese. But it later turns out, well, actually, he was poisoned. And that's why the reason why he was not able to fight the Japanese guy so well. And he finds out later that it was the cook that poisoned the Sifu, Fok Yun Gap.
Damn.
And so there's a scene where Bruce walks in and he sees, like, the cook and another conspirator.
Mm-hmm.
And in the scene, the moment Bruce opens the door, the camera pans basically to the guy's nipples. And then in both, obviously, the English and the Chinese version, he says, you know, so you're Japanese. And then so for the longest time, people always assumed, like, how did Bruce know the guy was Japanese from his nipples? Do Japanese men have different nipples than Chinese men, right? And then so I had asked this question to my wife at some point. Because this thing has come up, right? And I just go, like, yeah, my wife being from Hong Kong, I'm like, do Japanese men have different nipples than Chinese men? She just looked at me like I was crazy. I'm like, all right. So, no, it's because the character is wearing a harameki. A harameki is basically a waist wrap that goes around your stomach, similar to, like, you know, men wearing like kind of like a girdle around your midsection.
Uh-huh.
And that is a Japanese garment originally that was worn underneath armor, like samurai armor. You put it on there, presumably so you don't get chafed from the armor.
Mm.
But then even in the Second World War, when the Japanese men would go into battle, the family would make them one to wear underneath, which was supposed to give them good luck. And it was made like with 1,000 stitches or whatever, and made with like really good quality cloth, and they would wear it underneath, one, to keep warm, and two, because it was like it was supposedly for good luck. But basically, it's almost like a slimming thing you put around your waist.
Yeah.
And so when Bruce opens the door and they see, and the character, by the way, who plays the Japanese guy, is a Chinese actor. He's not even Japanese. It's that harameki that he's wearing around his midsection. It's not the nipples that gave it away. So that's the answer to that thing for people who
didn't know. Not the nipples.
Not the nipples.
The harameki.
There are no Japanese nipples that Bruce Lee recognized.
Man.
You must be Japanese.
Just right? Imagining your wife.
No. I ask her all sorts of stuff because, you know, my wife grew up in Hong Kong.
Mm-hmm.
But she didn't grow up, she didn't do martial arts growing up, and she didn't grow up, like, into any of this stuff, right? So it's kind of funny when I ask her these weird questions, because these are things that she's never had to really think about. And and so that's essentially the...
That's great.
That's why she's always looking at me like I'm crazy.
All right, so next up we got Shadowmancer 101.
All right, Shadowmancer 101.
Hi, Sifu Alex. American Dre. British Dre and Dryden.
Dryden. All right. All the guys.
All of them.
Yeah.
Love the show. Please keep up the good work. Or the great works. My bad.
Yeah. Not good work. Great work.
Thank you.
I recently had a dear friend and senior Sifu who is suffering from cancer. Even in his weakened state, he come to the Kun to help train and pass on his unique knowledge. This was obviously very emotional and moving gesture. It has deeply affected my training and focus. I was wondering if you have any similar experience in your training and teaching.
Wow, that's a heavy question for the KFG podcast.
Yeah.
Well, I feel sorry for his friend. That's a rough predicament to be in. I don't have a I don't have a, like a direct kind of similar thing in my life that I had. Although last year in 2020, Siva Elman Leung passed away. And I made a video about it here on this channel before we had this podcast. I made like a short little video. And, you know, Siva Elman Leung was an interesting character in the Wing Chun world because he was very... he was very humble and very understated, I suppose would be a word to kind of put in the wide world of WT where you had some, you know, you had lots of high profile guys, not just Sifu Leungting, we have Emin Bostepi, Sifu Kanspecht, all these guys from Europe, all these other guys from Hong Kong. And then like Sifu Elmin Leung was always like someone who never really went out and made a name for himself. But interestingly enough, he originally was a student of Grandmaster Yip Man before he became a student of Sifu Leungting. And I did an interview. It's one of the things I'm very happy about is that, you know, just a few years before Siva Elman passed, we had the chance to do a cover article for Wing Chun Illustrated. Ooh. And so for me, it was amazing because, like, you know, I write for Wing Chun Illustrated magazine, and occasionally when I have a column in Wing Chun Illustrated magazine called The Kung Fu Genius, but occasionally, like, there's some cover stories that I have also written. All right. So like, you know, I will contribute for those as well. The Chan Chi Man one, which came out a few issues ago, like I was the one who interviewed him for Wing Chun Illustrated, and Sifu Elmin Leung, I was the one who did that for the cover article. And so I was very happy that finally he got some recognition. He got to be on the cover and he got to be like the feature article because I feel like not that many people really knew about him. And Sifu Elmin Leung was such a like, phenomenal man. At the time that Wing Chun Illustrated magazine told me, like, they wanted to do something on Sifu Elmin Leung and basically could I, you know, get a hold of him and whatever. And I was like, yeah, sure. That was the time that, you know, when I, because I had not seen him as often in the recent years. I saw him more in the IWTA days. And then I saw him maybe once after I quit the IWTA. He actually came here to New York and taught a seminar for my students back in maybe 2012 or 2011, something like that, right? And so my students, yeah, had a chance to learn from him, and it was a lot of fun. But, you know, I just, like, in those years, you know, maybe an email here or a text message here, but nothing, like, I didn't see him that often because I was busy building my own association after I left the IWTA. And then so at the time that I contacted him, I was like, hey, Sibak, you know, Wing Chun Illustrated wants to do a cover story on him. His student told me that he had cancer. And so that hit me like an absolute gut punch because Sifu Elmin Leung, like, he has his students in San Francisco that he's been teaching for many years. And he has students who've been following him for a very long time and very loyal students. I learned from Sifu Elmin Leung on occasion. So I'm not like, I'm not someone who's like one of the guys who learned the most from him or anything like that. Yeah. But Sifu Elmin Leung had a huge influence in my Wing Chun career because in the, around the mid-2000s, while I was still in Sifu Leungting's organization, I had the chance to go and see him in San Francisco. And sometimes when Sifu Leungting came to New York, he would come over there. And I remember reading about him in the old books. And so I would spend some time with him, and my training partner Hao was learning from him. So he had some interesting takes on the Wing Chun system because he learned it a very long time ago from Sifu Leungting before WT became this international thing when it was still smaller. That was the time that he learned from Sifu Leungting. So he had like, he was like a window into like the really old methods. Mm-hmm. And I liked a lot of that stuff better than some of the newer stuff that would that was being taught in WT. And so he was a huge influence in certain things I do in Chi Sao, footwork, the plum flower step, other things. And I write about him a lot in the new Wooden Dummy book. And when I wrote my Wooden Dummy book, I mentioned him a handful of times in the book because he was a huge influence specifically on my Wooden Dummy training. I learned the Wooden Dummy form, and then I would go to him and he would give me like little corrections and tweaks and stuff like that, right? And then when I wrote the book, you know, and I may have mentioned this on a recent episode, but like then I had to, after he passed last year, I had to change all the references in the book to past tense. And that was brutal because I had already written the whole script. And now I had to go back and like I had to like, I had to change all it's like was, you know what I mean? And it was like really hard, right? But like for me, when I found out that he had cancer at the same time that I was able to do the interview for him, I was like, well, I'm really happy to do this now because I don't know what the prognosis is, and at least he'll have the chance to be on the magazine cover, and like I can do that. So I had the chance to kind of ask him. Most of the stuff I asked him were things I knew already because I had talked to him for many years.
Right.
And so he originally started learning Wing Chun from Grandmaster Yip Man as a teenager in the Wing Chun Athletic Association in the late 60s. And so his Sivu was actually Yip Man. But at that time, Yip Man was much older. And yeah, he wasn't really actively teaching. And he would tell me funny stories like, you know, even though Yip Man was his Sivu, you know, most of the time Yip Man would just kind of be sitting there smoking cigarettes. And usually a Sihing would be in charge of teaching them. And you say like, on one week, some Sihing would be telling them, do the Bong Sao and the turn like this.
Yeah.
And the next week, there'd be another Sihing there. And he would show to do the Bong Sao differently. And Yip Man is sitting in the corner both ways and says nothing, right? So people want to know, like, oh, how come, you know, people do different things? Like, literally, his own students were showing people right things there differently week to week, and he would just, he'd just be sitting there smoking cigarettes, right? And he had to take a short break from training Wing Chun to either prepare to go to university or college or take some exams or whatever. So he took a break, maybe 6 months, 9 months, something like that. And when he came back to the Wing Chun Athletic Association to resume his studies, basically Yip Man walked in with a young Liang Teng and said, well, this is the guy who's now going to be teaching at the Wing Chun Athletic Association. Because Yip Man had, you know, for the ninth time finally retired, right? So Sivu Liang Teng started to take over the classes at the Wing Chun Athletic Association late in the 60s. And so basically he was learning from Yip Man and Yip Man's students. And then he comes back and then Yip Man is like, okay, this is the guy who's going to be teaching now. And it was a young guy named Liang Teng. So Elman Leung just started following Liang Teng after that.
Right.
But he respected Sivu Liang Teng so much that he actually called Sivu Liang Teng Sifu, even though technically Yip Man was his Sifu. And it wasn't any disrespect to Yip Man. It was just showing a lot of respect to Liang Teng. And he, in essence, became one of Liang Teng's earliest students. So he learned, let's say, from 1967, 1968 until about 1974.
Okay.
And then he came to San Francisco and then he started teaching. And he was one of the early WT pioneers over here. And so for me, it was like when I found out that he was sick, I was very happy to have been able to do that interview for him and kind of get his name out there and all that kind of stuff. But I saw him the last time the year before he passed away. So in 2019, I went to California to see a friend of mine who lives out in Sacramento, and I stopped by San Francisco, and I saw Sivu Elman Leung, and he had gotten much better. Like, actually, he had improved quite a bit, but I could tell when I saw him, he was very thin. His hair was all gray suddenly. Like, you, I can definitely tell. He was a bit diminished, right? And so we went out to eat, and we kind of we sat and we had a very, very pleasant conversation and kind of like discussing things a little bit. And then after we ate, you know, I picked him up at his house. We went to a restaurant that was nearby, and then he asked me if I could drop him off at his doctor's because he had a doctor's appointment. So obviously, he's still going through his treatments, and I drove him to his doctor's and I said goodbye, and that was the last time I saw him. So, you know, it's like I was glad I had like one last time to kind of sit and talk to him. And
last
and,
hurrah.
Yeah. And so, yeah. And then about a year later, he passed away. So
I remember.
That's it. So, you know.
Man.
Mm-hmm.
Good old Steve Wellman.
No. Yep. Absolutely.
All right. All right. Man, that was nice, heavy question.
Yeah, heavy. I hope we have another nipples question next.
Yeah, yeah. Hopefully. Let's see. We got Loki. 696.
Okay.
Hello. A couple of questions.
All right. Here we go.
If Yip Man made up in the BJD.
Bacham Do.
Okay. Who helped him organize the form with its applications? Also, famous students that have finished the system with Yip Man, such as Ho Kam Ming, Mo Yat, Wang Shenlong, Leung Ting, Li Xing. Why are their BJD forms and applications so different from one another?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, it's also very speculative. I mean, like, you know, I've heard lots of different things, but you can't really say anything for sure. There are people who will tell you, oh, no, it's exactly this.
Okay.
To which you always have to ask, how do you know it's exactly that? All right.
Because I know.
Because they know, right? Or because someone who told them is someone that they happen to like, all right? And then so, well, I like that guy, and he told me this, so obviously it must be true.
Yeah.
The truth is that we don't really know.
Is that confirmation bias?
The confirmation bias. Okay. The Batam, though, is interesting because you don't really find a set of knife techniques called Batam, though, anywhere outside of Ip Man Wing Chun. So in some of the Wing Chun lineages that surround, you know, some of the other Wing Chun lineages outside of the Ip Man line, you have, like, some of them have double knives, and they just call them Seung Do. Seung Do literally means double knives, right?
Okay.
And, like, I believe in the Yun Kei San lineage, that's what they call it. And some of the other Wing Chun lineages don't have any knives. And so it's curious because in the Leung Chan lineage, all right, which we, you know, we descend from the Leung Chan lineage, but the Leung Chan lineage also split, and you have, like, the Gulo Wing Chun, which is not related to the Ip Man Wing Chun. There is no Batam, though, in the Leung Chan Gulo village Wing Chun. So it's difficult to see if Ip Man is the first one to have this knife form and these knife techniques called Batam Do, and you don't see it in the previous generations, then where did it come from? And so there's a lot of speculation, but that doesn't mean that it's true, all right? And that, you know, if you talk to the Yun Kei San people, they're going to tell you this because, well, it could be true, but you also have to be careful. They have an axe to grind on Ip Man. So, of course, what's very common in Chinese Kung Fu when you don't like another lineage, you're either going to say they're fake or they stole all your shit, okay? Because that's the only basis that most of these Wing Chun schools have to attack any other Wing Chun schools or any Kung Fu schools have to attack another Kung Fu school. They're not actually going to stand there and go toe-to-toe and try to smack each other. They're just going to... It's just all these stories and speculation. Oh, you know, actually, Batam Do comes from this guy or whatever. Okay, maybe, but that's literally just words coming out of your mouth. And unless you substantiate it, I'm under no obligation to believe it because the burden of proof rests on the person making the claim. It's not my job to refute your claim. It's your job to substantiate it. All right. And no one. And the problem is most of the discourse in Chinese Kung Fu, let's just say in Wing Chun in particular, is people who have made unsubstantiated claims and the other person trying to debunk unsubstantiated claims. And so for me, like if people ask me about the William Cheung story or people ask me about this or whatever, like, look, not my job to debunk that stuff. You need to show me the evidence that these things exist. And then if you, and it cannot just be because so-and-so said so. Like there needs to be some record, some proof, something you can put together where you can say this is how it happened. When you start to see that, then okay, now we can have a discussion. Until then, it's literally just something a dude said. All right? And people need to get...
Hearsay.
Yeah, it's called hearsay. Inadmissible in court. Okay? So...
Hearsay is spelled with the H-E-A-R?
Yes. Wow. All right, like I heard you say, all right?
That's deep.
Yes, so not here.
Not hearsay.
Hearsay, right?
Not, okay. We said it here.
Yes.
Yeah, that's heresy.
That's heresy, that's heresy, that's right. All right?
I love heresy.
Like Morrissey.
Morrissey.
Right? So,
that's racist.
Yes, so anyway.
Morrissey.
So, but we can look at a couple things and we can say, okay, there's no real Batam though that we can find that... that comes before the time of Ip Man. And we cannot find other Wing Chun lines that teach a double knife form using that specific name. So if we just look at those basic things, until we do, I mean, look, if a lineage comes out that legitimately says that they have a Batam Do system and it's unrelated to someone who learned from Ip Man, but it might be related to him in terms of someone who learned it, taught him or whatever, then you have a connection. Until then, it would seem as if the Batam Do is Ip Man's creation, all right? So it seems to be a relatively safe, though not guaranteed, bet to place, okay? So then the question is, well, how did he develop this and who did he develop with and who did he organize the applications with? And the problem is that is already now an assumption based on the first speculation, okay? So I cannot speculate on how did he develop a form and who helped him. First of all, who says anyone helped them? Okay. If at some point most people design or develop martial art fighting skills and then maybe they test it out, that doesn't mean that they have to have two or three people there and do this by committee. Okay. All right. So, so the problem is that the question itself is very speculative It has to assume the first thing, which is that Ip Man created it, so we can go that far. But then the problem, it goes, well, then who helped him do it? Well, hey, that is already a step too far, because, first of all, who says anyone helped him do it?
Mm-hmm.
How do you know he didn't just create the whole thing himself and use his own martial arts expertise and experience training this with his students to develop this thing over time? Okay. So that's the first thing. I'm not going to answer assumptive questions. There were people, the Siulam Wangchun people, not so much the ones in Hong Kong, but the Europeans who have learned from them, who are now 50 some odd years past all of this stuff, saying that Ip Man secretly developed this with Chu Chong Man. All right.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know about that. There is a lot of evidence to say that probably did not happen. But anyway, it's not my job to debunk it. You know why? Because the thing that Ip Man trained with Chu Chong Man, or Chu Chong Man showed him some footwork, and that's the footwork we have in the Bacham Do, that shit is all hearsay. It's not my job to debunk it. You got to substantiate that story as something that's even worth listening to. Otherwise, it's literally something told to you by someone over dim sum. And I don't have time to refute shit people said over dim sum.
Or soups.
Bring actual evidence that can point to this.
Mm.
All right? And don't just say, oh, well, so-and-so really knew. No. So-and-so told you so-and-so really knew. That doesn't mean shit. These are literally just things people say. All right? Like, you cannot spend so much time refuting shit that people say. Imagine refuting stories that are speculations to begin with. It's like, who's wasting more time? The person who speculates or the person who refutes the speculation?
Look at all these rumors.
All right, now surrounding me every day.
Surrounding me.
I just need some time. Some time to get away.
Get away.
From all these rumors.
Can't right? take it no more.
So, yeah. So anyway, Cameo, jeez. Right?
Oh, man. So, I don't know if that was Cameo.
Was that Cameo? Who was that?
It might have been... Damn, I don't know who that is.
All right, we'll just say it's Cameo until someone in the comments goes, actually, it was Stevie B or whatever.
It's gonna be Dryson.
Yeah, it's gonna be Dryson, right?
Yeah.
So that's the first thing. It's like, I'm not gonna speculate on who did he develop it with when we don't even know whether he developed it or not. Like, who knows? All right. Speculation on top of speculation.
Might have been SOS band, by the way.
Who the hell knows? All right. So there's that thing, right? And then the second thing is, you know, why are all the different Bacham Do of the students different? And I'll tell you. I don't actually think they are that different. So, you know, different is all relative, right? If you hold something and you lift your elbow up more, you do it here. For some Wing Chun people, that's a world of difference. For other people, it's just a variation, and this is not worth mentioning.
Yeah,
as
my
a difference,
mom wouldn't
right?
be able to tell the difference.
Yeah, so the problem is, okay, it depends on what your threshold is for things being different, okay? So I've had the luck to learn two different versions of the Bacham Do. Both the Leung Ting version, which we could consider it as a very late period, end of Ip Man's life version. And then I also learned a version my Sibak taught me, which is the one he learned from Chan Chi Man. I didn't learn it directly from Chan Chi Man. I learned it from my Sibak, who learned it from Chan Chi Man.
Okay.
The Chan Chi Man Bacham Do is from the period of Wong Sun Leung, and it's very similar to Wong Sun Leung's original form. Wong Sun Leung modified his Bacham Do a little bit, admittedly, and so it's a little bit different from what Chan Sifu does, but apparently the original version Wong Sun Leung did is very similar to Chan Sifu's, right? So I've learned, to a certain degree, a very early period Bacham Do and a very latter period Bacham Do. And then you have middle period students, Hokam Ming, Mo Yat, and I've seen their Bacham Do forms. And so for me, it doesn't seem so divergent, because when you've learned both of them, I've learned the two extremes, the early and the late, and then I see the middle period one, I see that there's a common thread between all of them in terms of there are certain moves that are present in all three of those eras that are the same, even if the execution is a little bit different.
Okay.
They all have Kando, they all have some form of Kapto, they all have some form of Yat-Ti-Do, they all have certain stamps of like, and Mando against the overhead type. They all have these things in there, right? So actually, you know, the earlier period, they do the Mando a little more side-on, the latter period is a little more square, but like, you can futz about the differences of those things, but they all have mando. They all have yatsido. They all have gapdo, the clamping knife, right? So you can see that they're all present. And when I look at all three of those eras, the early period one, the Chanchi Man version that I know, the middle period one from Haokan Ming's students' videos or Moyet's students' videos, and then the Langcheng one, I actually just see it's just a through line of they're very similar. Okay. And this thing maybe developed over time, and Yip Man didn't teach it so often. So every time he taught it, maybe he changed it a little bit. So I don't think that there was a very specific set, which would tend to go to the fact that Yip Man most likely developed it. So he had some ideas, some movements. These are different ways of using the Bacham-do against different weapons. But in terms of like set choreography, because he didn't teach it openly, there are not too many photographs of him with it. He had plausible deniability. I could teach you one thing, mm-hmm. and if I only taught it to three other students and you guys don't always see each other, and then I croak, I literally could have taught these four students who are close to me something a little bit different.
Yeah.
So that's totally possible. Plus, students are naturally going to do things differently and do things with their own spin, and some people are more interested in weapons and some people are less interested in weapons. So your mileage may vary in terms of how much your lineage, like how much your sifu really decided to go in and learn, like get good at the weapons versus what most of us practice in Wing Chun, which is the hand fighting stuff. So some people learn the weapons because it's like an ornamental part of the system they have to learn, and some other people really get into the weapons and, you know, train the pole and train the knives and want to get good at it. And so that also, like, two students could have legitimately learned the Bacham-do from Yip Man, but the one guy doesn't emphasize it that much because he's more about learning the fist fighting, and the other person emphasized it a lot, and maybe because they emphasized it a lot, developed it a little bit, and that's why that might have still changed a little bit. So these are supernatural variations that occur within one school where you have the same sifu. You're naturally going to have variations, all right? If you look at all my instructors now, the sifu level instructors under me who are actively teaching, they all teach the same Wing Chun, they teach our program, but they all do it differently because you have to adapt it to your body type, you have to adapt it to your temperament, to your own personal experience. And so these are all students who learn the same program from the same guy. Mm-hmm. Now we look at Yip Man, who didn't write his program down. He didn't have high standards about this or that or the other thing. I mean, if he liked you, you learned a lot. And if he didn't like you, you didn't learn so much. So honestly, it wasn't a very fair teaching system. I mean, I get it's part of Chinese culture, but if Yip Man's Wing Chun school existed in the time of Google, he'd have 2 stars because most of the people he gave 0 shits about, right? So people would be like, yeah, I went there. No one really paid attention to me. Those would be the Google reviews for Yip Man's school. All right. But he existed in a time before that. So what do you see? You see the best guys who made it out of there. Okay. And you don't see all the people who just kind of spun their wheels for years because the training is not very progressive. Right. So naturally, you're going to have variations, even if Yip Man taught the same Bacham-do throughout the 20 some odd years that he taught Wing Chun, more or less. I know he taught seriously for 10 years, but basically he was alive in Hong Kong for about 22 years after he started teaching. So in theory, he could have still been teaching stuff up until the day he died to a couple of private students, whatever. So if you give him that, if he taught the same Bacham-do form for 20 years with no variation, his students would still be doing it differently.
Yeah.
So people need to get over that. First of all, there's nothing to indicate that he did teach the Bacham-do the same way over all those years. But even if he did, all the people who legitimately learned it from would still be doing it differently. That's as normal as it gets.
Oh, right.
Yeah.
So what was that lyric again?
About rumors?
Yeah.
Look at all these rumors surrounding me every day.
Yeah, that's what I thought.
I just need some time. Is it a cameo?
No, it is not.
Who is
SOS,
it?
SOS, man.
Timex Social Club.
Timex Social Club. All right.
Yeah. They were close to Club Nouveau.
Oh,
that's why I was trying.
Yeah,
I was like,
Club Nouveau is another dope.
I thought it was Club Nouveau, but I was like, no, it's Timex Social Club.
All right.
Who's cameo? He's the Wern Up.
Yeah.
Is that him?
Yep.
Yeah, okay, right.
Yeah.
He had a cameo haircut.
Yeah, that's right. All right, what else we got?
Basically, it comes down to you just got to substantiate your BJD, my G.
That's right.
That's it.
The red codpiece.
Yes. Yeah. Hey, Kung Fu Genius listeners, if you're looking for an easy way to support this podcast, please consider joining the Kung Fu Genius Patreon. You can support for as little as $5 a month and get access to episodes a few days early. Higher levels of support get additional goodies, exclusive content, and even your name in the description. The baller level of support will give you the opportunity to be a Dre for a day and give me a rest from this guy over here. A link for the Kung Fu Genius Patreon page is in the description below. You can also support us by subscribing to the Kung Fu Genius on YouTube, liking this video, and sharing it on your social media platforms. When you subscribe on YouTube, don't forget to hit that bell for notifications so you will know as soon as a new episode or a premiere is available for you to watch. For those of us who listen to us on audio, it's a huge help if you don't just rate the podcast, but also write a review wherever you listen to the Kung Fu Genius, such as Apple or Google Podcasts. I really appreciate it. And now back to me.
All right, next up we got Miki Milosnik. Milosnich.
All right.
Milosnich.
Uh-huh.
Hey, Sifu.
Yo.
Could you tell us some stories of maybe exchanges and fights between Wing Chun and styles that were known in the underworld, like Chao Gar and Pak Mei? Were there some fights between Yip Man and other famous Sifus you know of? Blessings.
Not during, I mean, people forget Yip Man was quite old by the time he came to Hong Kong. So, I mean, like, you have to.
His 50s, right?
Yeah, he was like in his mid to late 50s when he first came to Hong Kong, basically started teaching, right? So, damn. Of course, you know, he would demonstrate Wing Chun and convince some of his early students that he could do something. But, I mean, he's not Donnie Yen from the IP Man movies fighting, you know, generals and sergeants from the American military, you know, in San Francisco or whatever, right? Yeah. So, there's a lot of that kind of stuff. So it wouldn't be normal that someone at his stage of life and his age would be like scrapping, right? In general, like an established Sifu, it's like it's the students, it's the senior students who go out and fight, right? It's not the Sifu themselves, right? Maybe in the younger days, but in the younger days he was in China and we don't really know that much about what he did back then. We just have some stories and things like that. So I haven't really heard anything about Yip Man fighting other Sifus in Hong Kong during that time. Because I think at the time he's old and, you know, they usually have a friendly relationship with the other ones, right? I mean, there are people who are going to say this or whatever, but again, substantiate it. Don't just tell me so-and-so told me that this doesn't mean anything, all right? I have a podcast. I can also make shit up. Mm-hmm. And you can say, well, the Kung Fu Genius said it. Well, hey, unless it's true, it's only true if it's true, okay? So I don't know about that, right? But I do know that very early on, there was an unfortunate incident between, I believe it was Wong Sun Leung, and someone of Chao Ga Mantis, all right? Where something had happened and then maybe it was Wong Sun Leung, maybe it wasn't Wong Sun Leung, but someone had gotten beaten in the Chao Ga Mantis. Now, by the way, in the previous episode, maybe last week, maybe a week before, I'm a huge fan of Chao Ga Mantis. So, like, I don't want anyone's takeaway from me saying this to be like, oh, Wing Chun beat up Mantis. First of all, it's not style versus style. It's person versus person. Someone in the Wing Chun family, I'm going to presume it was Wong Sun Leung, beat up someone from the Chao Ga Mantis family. That is not Wing Chun defeating Mantis. That is Wong Sun Leung or whoever defeating that particular individual. So I just want to say that because in Kung Fu, it's always like if someone, you know, beats someone, everyone's like, oh, see, this style beat that style. No. This dude beat that dude, okay? So, you know, anyway. And I know that there was an unfortunate incident and that they, you know, were potentially going to send some of their students over and maybe there were some triad connections or whatever. But Chan Chi Man told me the story. But he told me this 2 or 3 years ago. I have it recorded at home.
All right.
So I don't want to say anything now because I don't remember exactly, but I did ask him about this. So I'll go back and review it before I say definitively what happened, right? Because I don't want to confuse any of the details, but something happened and there was something that was going on. And for like a period of a few weeks, There was some threat that, you know, some of those guys were going to come to the Yip Man school and try to beat up Yip Man, or they were going to send some triads in there or whatever. And Chanchi Man told me that Yip Man was like, he left the door open. He said, whatever, let people come. I don't care. But I don't remember exactly what the setup was. So I'm going to have to go back and double check that. So maybe on a future episode, if you remind me, I'll give you the update before on that. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. Yes, I like that. Mikey D, you gotta send me a reminder text or something.
About what? About what? Yeah, he needs a reminder text and the reminder text.
Right.
Tell the KFG to look up that Chow Ga Wing Chun story.
Yeah.
So I can tell it on a future episode.
Yeah, no, I got it. Don't worry. This is an age-related decline. No.
Age-related decline for sure. Old.
Sage related.
Yes.
Yeah.
All right. What else we got?
Antonio.
What?
Sorry, no, Dre. Sorry.
That's
Dre.
What?
All right. I don't look like Antonio. All right. Next up, we got Dryzen.
Oh, bloody hell.
Bloody hell.
And Dryzen is asking a hypothetical.
Oh, jeez. Here we go.
And he's asking, yo, Sifu. Alex. Yo, Sifu, Alex.
I think he's got a bit of a cheat calling you by your first name.
Yeah. All right. What's up? Come on.
Sifu Alex. Hypothetical question, bro.
Bro.
That's what he wrote, man. Come on, man. Don't question me.
You know familiarity breeds contempt, Dre.
I don't know.
All right. Let's go. Spit it out. Let's go.
I'm trying to get through it, but there's interruptions in the room.
Yes,
you know?
Yeah, from yourself.
So, one day you at the crib and you decide to try the Bruce Lee challenge. And you ask your wife to cook you five soups, different soups. And you try to eat these soups up, boom, 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 real quick, less than 5 minutes. Doesn't work. But anyway, you go to sleep all like, feeling all,
bubble gutty.
Yeah. You fall asleep, surprisingly. And all of a sudden, you wake up. Boom! You fell off your bed. You wake up, you're like, yo. And then you notice you're literally on the floor and you look under the bed. And you see these two guys run into the room. And they get under the bed looking for a book.
Uh-huh.
And they're under there looking, and they find this book. And they get up, they take the book, and they start looking through the book right there in the room. They're just like, oh, shit. And they run out the room with the book.
This isn't the Dimmak book under Yip Man's bed, is it?
That's what, I don't know, but I didn't finish reading.
All right. I feel I know where this is going.
They run out. They're like, yes, got the book. Wow, that's crazy, this
language.
Book. I mean, we got this book. We got this book.
Got it.
And then you're like, what the? Is that book, that famous book? And then you look over to the side and you see another book. You grab that book. You're like, yo.
This what is it, Webster's Dictionary?
You grab that book and you open it. Uh-huh. And it's Yip Man's notes.
Oh, nice. Writing notes for you to do this as ASMR.
Yes. This feels like
did
ASMR.
Did I get closer to Mike?
You're getting closer now.
And then you see Yip Man's notes, and you open it, and you start reading it.
Hey, ASMR,
and you get
anything.
Very, very sleepy.
This not the Ask Me Anything, just the ASMR. All anything.
Right, let's go.
So you start reading, you're like, yo, these are Yip Man's notes.
Mm-hmm. On what?
Wing Chun.
Oh, okay. I don't know. It could be notes on the recipes he likes to cook.
Soups.
Yeah, soups.
Soup recipes. All right. What do you do?
Do I have my phone with me?
I don't know. You fell out of bed. You
if I have
you
my keep phone with me, I just take snapshots.
In your bed, do you keep your phone on you? Like right in your pocket? You
I
fell.
Have the phone next
you
to
fell
me.
Off the bed, but as you're falling through gravity.
I have a sleep app. That I have to put the phone next to me, and it basically tracks how long I sleep and my breathing patterns, all that kind of stuff. So I literally do quit.
Right
frankly,
next to you.
It's right next to me.
But it's still on the bed in the past. All
right, whatever.
Or in the future. Uh-huh. Because as you fall.
I'll take the book.
You fall.
I'll take the book.
Into the past. Okay, so you take the book.
I take the book with me.
Yeah?
Yeah.
And then you try to find your way back to the future.
I try to find my way back to the future. And then I publish this book.
Oh.
Yip Man's Secret Notes.
What?
By Dryson. Oh. So I wouldn't put that under my name. No. Copyright, all that kind of stuff,
right? Of course you wouldn't.
Yeah.
You shouldn't.
Yeah. And that's the answer to that question.
All right. All right. Damn. Got locked out.
Yeah, good job, Ace.
Yes. All right. Next up, we got R.M. Puig. I've heard that there was a double hacking arm attack that used to be part of the 4 or 5 Wing Chun attacks. What was the reason for not teaching it anymore? Is it due to it being reserved for more advanced students?
I assume he's talking about the double pecta.
I'm thinking double pecta. Yeah. I'm thinking it.
No, we teach it.
Yeah, we teach that shit openly.
Yeah, we teach it openly. I don't know.
I got openly destroyed by them.
Yeah, I know. I don't know. So the problem with WT, the Liang Ting lineage, is that it's so wide, like spread out throughout the world, that it's all, YMMY, or YMMV, sorry. Your mileage may vary, right?
Okay.
You're like, how come this stuff is not taught? And I go, to whom? We teach that stuff here. Or how come this is done this way? We don't do it that way. Uh-huh. Right? So the problem is that you can make no general statements about WT now because it's so widespread. And a lot of what the guys are doing in Europe is very different from what the guys are doing in Hong Kong. So, I mean, like, no. I mean, that Lao Tzu attack that he's talking about is standard program stuff, man. Nothing special.
All right.
Mm-hmm.
Next up, we got Imre Szabo.
Okay.
Szabo.
All right.
Hello, from Budapest.
Nice. Budapest, a great city. Love it.
Yeah, I haven't been yet.
Yeah.
Love your channel, Sifu Alex. My question for you is as follows. What are the 8 principles of Wing Chun Kyun in Cantonese?
I assume he means the 8 characters, which essentially... inform 8? Us in terms of how we move and interact with an opponent, right?
Uh-huh.
But I wouldn't say that they're 8 principles. They're 8 characters, right. but they're not 8 separate things, okay? So you have Loi Lao Hui Song, La Sao Chik Chong, right? Loi means to something comes, all right? Lao means to stay, all right? So that means that whatever comes towards you, like maybe a punch or something like that, you stick to it, you stay. So this can imply sticking to something.
Mm-hmm.
This can imply sticking and moving out of the way of something, right? So I don't pull my hand away from the thing I'm sticking, because mm-hmm. then I cannot feel what the guy's doing. I stay with it. So I could use it to turn, I could use it to unload power, or I could just stick. So it's not 100% clear in terms of what it means. That term Lao can mean to stay, so you can interpret it any way you want. And this is part of the reason why there's so much contention in Wing Chun, because also the term Lao, the very same character, could also mean stop, depending on how you use it. So that's why some Wing Chun lineages could say, whatever comes, you try to stop it. And they can use that as a justification of hard style blocks in Wing Chun. And they would, in their interpretation, actually still be faithful to those characters, right? Because it's somewhat ambiguous in terms of how you use it, right? So that's like whatever comes, you stay with it, all right? Hui means to go away, all right? And then song is like to send off. So if something goes away, you send it off, meaning like you think about forward pressure and like a spring. When your opponent backs up, your spring is still going forward and it's going with your opponent towards them. So you don't keep your arm there and your partner goes away and your arm is staying there. Your arm is naturally spring loaded, ready to go forward, right? So those are like the first 4 characters. Lat so, lat means the hand is freed, all right? Or the hand is now separated, right? Chek chong. Chek means straight. Chong means to thrust. So it essentially means whatever comes, you stay with it. Whatever goes away, you escort it or follow. And if the arm is completely free, you thrust forward. Those are not 8 principles. They're 8 Chinese characters.
Okay.
I would say it's actually 3 ideas being represented there in 8 characters. The European formulation was to make it 4 fighting principles because they added if the way is free, go forward, which is the Chinese don't add that if the way is free, go forward, which is the idea of man zao, sending a hand forward, because in many Chinese Wing Chun formulations, it's understood that you send your hands forward. So they don't have to add that as like, you got to send your hands forward and then you stick, stay, or thrust forward as the hand is freed. That's naturally understood, whereas the European formulation, they had to add that to make it just a little bit more clear. That's why the Western European version is that there are four principles. The Chinese formulation is that there are three ideas, but those three ideas are expressed over those eight characters.
Love it, man. Love it. Thank you for that question, dude. All right, next up, we got TK. Hilarious episode.
I assume he's talking about the Beardy episode.
I'm assuming the same thing.
Yeah.
Ashamed to say I saw a couple of Beardy videos in the past.
Yeah, yeah.
But the one about training a year was the last one I saw. Never thought much of it. Future question. Sorry if this has been asked hundreds of times. What are your thoughts on the upcoming DKU versus Zhu Xiaodong,
Xu Xiaodong
match?
Interesting. Well, to the first part, just so our podcast listeners realize how early we record these episodes, because at the time of this recording, like right now while we're recording this, this is the week that the Beardy episode came out, right?
Yeah, but of course, so this is kind of fresh.
Why we have a lot of like Beardy comments. So we didn't actually have a lot of new questions. People were just saying how, you know, what a fraud Beardy is. But this is to give our podcast listeners some context, because by the time this episode actually comes out, it's going to be like weeks and weeks and weeks. And it's like, just so they realize how much of a delay there was between, you know,
that,
when we
that match
these
already
episodes.
Happened. Yeah,
maybe that match already happened. So DKU is, again, he's one of these internet stars who's kind of a JKD-esque kind of way of moving, with a little bit of Wing Chun, with a little bit of Taekwondo. And he's a Korean guy, right? And he's huge on Instagram and huge on social media. And when you look at the guy, I mean, he can move very well. Obviously,
explosively.
Obviously, most of what he's doing are controlled demonstrations, and that's fine. Like, I mean, that stuff looks cool, and he's doing some very interesting things. Some stuff looks very much like JKD, some stuff a little bit like Wing Chun, some stuff like boxing. I think he's had some books or whatever. But the weird thing is, like, that's the thing with the social media era, is that you have these guys who are like, they're these huge stars because they know how to work the algorithm. They know the kind of things that the casuals like, and these kind of very interesting demonstrations that people think are really cool, especially people who don't know that much about martial arts, and they really bring it. But for like salty old dogs like me, or people like I'm sure maybe Sifu David Peterson, who's you know, one very legitimate Wing Chun instructor from the line of Wong Sun Leung, as well as other people, I think a lot of us look at this something like, where are these people coming from? Because you know, like, who the major players are in the Wing Chun world, and like now it's been so many years, so a lot of the first generation guys, if they haven't passed away, it's their students or their students' students. So the conversations the actual Wing Chun practitioners have is like, oh, this is so-and-so who is from this line. So you have a little bit of an idea of what they might do, or this is from the person from this line. But now there's like these Wing Chun people that were kind of created in a lab. Now, I'm not saying DKU is a Wing Chun person. I'm just saying, like, these people who come from these martial arts backgrounds, like, where are these people even coming from?
Like,
right?
A British Sifu, Master Wong.
Yeah.
Now look at me. What are you looking at me?
We don't need to talk about Master Wong, right? So, anyway, like, DKU is one of these guys, and like, you know, I see his stuff, and like, I'm like, well, I mean, a guy like looks like he moves really well, but I mean, most of what he's doing is willing participants, and that's okay. I mean, like, you demonstrate something, you're not if you're an instructor, like, say I get it, like, people go like, oh, that guy's not even fighting back. Well, calm down, Tito. I don't mean Tito Ortiz, I mean Tito Jackson. When an instructor is demonstrating techniques, they're demonstrating it on someone who's allowing them to demonstrate. Listen, you go to Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu school, and the professor wants to show you an arm lock. He's showing you the arm lock step by step, or she's showing you the arm lock step by step, and their partner is there so that they're there to facilitate that demonstration. All right? That's not the same as live sparring. So, like, when like, kind of the MMA and modern martial art pros who's going, yo, man, dude's like, this guy's not even fighting back. Hey, if you're looking at clips from a seminar, more than likely you're looking at him demonstrating whatever he's teaching to the students to do at that moment. No one said that this is an all-out fight and he's doing it against a resisting opponent.
Okay.
Having said that, sometimes those guys make a lot of claims for what they can do, and they don't show you them against a resisting opponent, right? And so I don't care if someone just demonstrates techniques or whatever. The problem is when someone now makes a big claim about how effective or badass they are as a fighter. And I believe that DKU, and I haven't followed it that much, has made some claims about him, how good he actually is as a fighter. Mm-hmm. And that's the moment where you go, all right, now you've made a claim that you need to substantiate, right? So, you know, there have been some interviews, I think, with him. And you know, he essentially, from what I understand, and mind you, I don't really follow that guy too much. But from what I understood, he essentially gives off the impression that in real life, in a real fight, he's basically that same guy you see demonstrating on his students over there. Like, he can do all that stuff in real time against a resisting opponent in a similar way. All mm-hmm. right. So, all right, you know, it's kind of like, you know, he does inch punch or no inch punch demonstrations where his hands on them. Like, you know, it's, he talks about body mechanics and all these kind of these things that get casuals super, super excited. And so Xu Xiaodong is that Chinese mixed martial arts fighter who's been, you know, beating up old Tai Chi guys and beating up Wing Chun guys who've never fought in the ring before. I have mixed feelings about Xu Xiaodong, all right? Mm-hmm. My mixed feelings are this. Yes, I teach Wing Chun. I'm a traditional martial arts guy, and I'm not happy to see Wing Chun guys get their ass kicked.
But you love MMA.
But no, it's not even that. But I'm also happy to see some Wing Chun guys get their ass kicked.
Yeah, okay.
Because I think people need to stay in their lane. Mm-hmm. If you teach self-defense or you teach a martial art or something, you need to know what you're doing, what you're teaching, and what the value of that. What can you actually do with this thing that I'm showing you? And a lot of the traditional martial art guys, you may be teaching someone a way to effectively defend themselves if they're suddenly attacked or something like that, right? But they claim they can also then fight in the ring using these same exact tactics. And I go, no, if you want to fight in the ring, you have to understand how to fight in the ring, rules, boxing, kickboxing, footwork, moving back and forth, and you can maybe apply your Wing Chun ideas in there if the base is somewhat modified, right? I'm not talking about the dude takes a swing at you on 6th Avenue, okay? Yeah. You just go forward and the fight is on. There is no back and forth or anything like that, right? These things are different, but the problem is some people who are surrounded by yes men, they don't see the difference, and they really think that the same guy they are demonstrating on their willing students is the same guy they would be if they were in a ring across from Mike Tyson, right? So Xu Xiaodong, to a certain degree, has exposed a lot of that bullshit. Mm-hmm. And so when people go, oh, what do you think about Xu Xiaodong beating up that Wing Chun guy? I'm like, oh, the Wing Chun guy had it coming.
Yeah.
You know, people think, oh, what's your Wing Chun guy? Does that make you upset? Well, first of all, I don't know who that Wing Chun guy was.
Yeah.
They said he's the number four Wing Chun guy in Hong Kong. I'm like, well, what is the number four Wing Chun guy in Hong Kong even mean?
Me?
First of all, it's not like when you fly into the airport in Hong Kong, there's like a leaderboard there with like the top 10 Wing Chun people in Hong Kong. And, you know, this dude is number four, and that's the guy who fought Xu Xiaodong, and he beat Xu Xiaodong beat his ass. I never heard of that guy before, okay? Now, that doesn't mean he's not good or he's not legit or whatever, but what does it mean, the number four? It almost feels like the promoters, you know, don't want to say this is the number one Wing Chun guy, because then everyone would be like, we never heard of this guy. So they say he's the number four Wing Chun guy. No one is going to refute it, right? So you go like, well, who even is this guy, right? And if you're a Wing Chun person and you want to fight in the ring against a mixed martial artist or a kickboxer, you need to know something about mixed martial arts and kickboxing. Even if you want to apply a Wing Chun strategy, you need to be in the ring with someone and have some training to know what that pressure is like, how to fight in the ring with the cage, whatever. And if you've never done that before, okay, then the results are pretty obvious, all right? So on one hand, I'm all for Xu Xiaodong kicking the crap out of these delusional pajama-wearing Tai Chi guys or Wing Chun guys or whatever, all right? On the other hand, all right, most of the people that Xu Xiaodong fights,
ooh,
he's bigger than them, okay? Ooh. Which I kind of go like, okay. Mm. Especially coming from a sports martial art background, wouldn't you want to maybe fight someone near your weight? So he's fighting people that he outweighs, oftentimes by a measurable, like a substantial amount of weight. Mm. Two, he's also fighting people who have almost admittedly no ring fighting experience, and who are clearly delusional about their own skills. Now, I know a couple people who train in mixed martial arts. I know Nick Dalby, who's in the UFC. I've met him before. And I know a number of people in the jiu-jitsu world, and, you know, people from the Henzo camp, like, I know some people, right? I don't know anyone from, like, of the, my friends who do mixed martial arts or people who train in the Henzo group or whatever, or certainly not Nicholas Dalby, who would take pride in beating the crap out of amateurs that they outweighed. Mm-hmm. Now, it's different if it's like a bully beatdown. This guy's, you know, like Deontay Wilder beat up that dude who claims to be a big boxer. And the guy was like some racist punk or whatever. And Deontay Wilder, this is a number of years ago. He beat the shit out of that guy, right? And it's like, okay, well, this guy has it coming because he's an asshole, right? Mm-hmm. But these are just delusional amateur martial artists from traditional martial arts background who've never fought in the ring. And he outweighs them. So, like, on the surface, it's like, here are these delusional kung fu people getting their asses kicked, which I'm happy for those people to be exposed.
Okay.
But on the other hand, whenever I hear that Xu Xiaodong beat up another dude, the headline for me is semi-professional mixed martial arts fighter beats up smaller amateur with no fighting experience. Mm. And I go, that's the actual headline. Yeah, it's a kung fu, and I'm not trying to be a kung fu apologist, but I go, I don't know anyone in the jiu-jitsu world or the mixed martial arts world who would take pride in kicking the shit out of someone who doesn't have any ring experience and they outweigh by a ton,
yeah,
who wasn't being outwardly like a bully. So that's the part where I go, like, I'd love to see Xu Xiaodong actually fight in mixed martial arts against someone in his weight class, and then we would see how good that guy actually is, right? Because to a certain degree, how many of us couldn't also go in the ring against some Tai Chi guy that we outweigh who comes in with his silk pajamas and we got little gloves on. I think it would be problematic for most of those guys. But then am I going to like raise my hands up because I beat up some 5'2" Tai Chi guy who weighed 110 who came in with silk pajamas and I just boxed his face off and go, yeah, yeah, Tai Chi's bullshit. Yeah, I mean, like, man, take it easy, all right? Like, look who you're fighting, man.
Sure you don't want to do that, though?
So anyway, supposedly, DKU has agreed to fight Xu Xiaodong. And this is pretty major. Now, at the time of this episode coming out, I don't know if that fight's actually happened because I'm not really following it that I'm a casual follower of this thing.
When did this...
They've been talking about it for a little bit, and then there was like a moment where Xu Xiaodong might not be able to fight because, yeah, I think he has a visa issue, but I think that that has been resolved or whatever. So I think they actually are going to fight. So for me, people ask me about this, and it's like, who do you think is going to win? Xu Xiaodong is going to kill this guy. What are you talking about, right? Do these people really believe that DKU is the same guy in the ring against a semi-professional fighter that he is when he's demonstrating against willing participants, people who are wearing motorcycle helmets so he can whale them in the face while he's not wearing anything, which means he can hit them, they cannot hit him because he's not wearing any equipment, which already shows you how these demonstrations are set up. So I don't think it's any surprise what's going to happen there. So I think someone asked me, like, what do I think is going to happen? I'm like, DKU trips on the way into the ring and knocks himself out, right?
Oh, no, I mean, come on.
We know what this outcome is, right? And this is not a knock on JKD or Wing Chun or Bruce Lee or whatever. It's a knock on these fantasists who don't understand that they are outside of their wheelhouse in here, all right? Completely outside, all right? And that's all I got to say about that. All right, everyone. So I hope you enjoyed that episode of The Kung Fu Genius. As always, please don't forget to subscribe to The Kung Fu Genius. Hit that bell for notifications. And if you're looking for any kind of training or you want to get books by The Kung Fu Genius, go to citywt.com. And as always, I'll see you guys next time. Word is I'm a Kung Fu Genius. Technique speaks for me, not lineage. Forget Jet Li, cause I'm the one. Many call me Sifu, but to you I'm Seagung. And I produce masters, you surpassed us. Your kung fu stiffer than corpse and caskets. City Wing Chun is the house I built. Violate the gate and your blood gets spilt. Alex Richter, always the victor. Lots of DK, yo! Yo, that's good.
Lots of...
There was a big topic I talked about right at the top, which I talked about for a long time.
Luke, Cap, got any tips on starting your school? Dryson's nemesis. Can you give some explanation on why Way of the Dragon, blah, blah, blah. See for Alex, the British Dryden, love
nipples.
Show.
Nipples. There you go. Wow, look at that. That was awesome. Fist bump.
Bam.
Bam. And off. I'm sorry.